Next case is 98-15-29, State of Ohio versus Jose Mesa.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, my name is Chris Fry, representing the State of Ohio in this matter, along with, pardon me, my colleague, George Sett. Your Honors, before we get to the merits of the case before the court, I would like to ask or point specifically to the second proposition of law, and that is that the arrest warrant in this case is somehow deficient, was issued without probable cause. That matter is not for review today in this court. It was not the subject of a cross appeal pursuant to this court's Rule 2, Section 2. It has never been accepted by this court for jurisdiction. And the state would respectfully ask that this court strike any discussion or consideration of that proposition that the defendant, I believe, has raised in his brief.
Well, if we do that, it'd be fair then to strike yours too. The procedural difficulties that you encountered, for instance, not preserving part of this for right to appeal.
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to the search incident to the arrest. It is our position that this was an inventory search, and we've never deviated from that position. However, this court, as the court below, had the ability to recognize well-settled law. If this court chooses to review it on that matter, they certainly can. The point of the matter is that this proposition of law, too, did not get preserved for purposes of this appeal.
How did yours get preserved with regard to the search? You're asking us to take cognizance of well-established law. Why can't we take cognizance of well-established law on the appellee's side as
we
well?
We have no opinion of the court below as to the propriety of the arrest warrant. None whatsoever. All that this court has before it is the decision of the trial court saying that that arrest warrant was properly issued. That matter was not raised for appeal in the Court of Appeals, nor has it been preserved here. If this court decides that the Court of Appeals and the trial court were in error, it can do so for reasons other than what we have proposed in our brief and is considered by this court on our brief on the merits. I'm not going to stand here and argue the search incident to the arrest. I'm going to argue, hope to argue for the court this morning that the inventory search was properly conducted.
Yeah, and that boils down to that a console is not a container.
I believe that is correct boiling of the issue, Your Honor. I think there are two things before the court. And first is, does the Lakewood inventory policy authorize the search of the unlocked center console? And I think the answer to that question is emphatically yes. And the second question is, what does that decision or contention do to State versus Hackman? And I think the answer to that is nothing. State versus Hackman continues to be good law in the area that it serves, and that is the search of a container in an automobile. There is a clear distinction to be made between a container and a compartment. This court said so in Hackman. The Supreme Court said so in Florida v. Wells, that an inventory of an automobile must be conducted with three principles in mind. It must be reasonable. It must be in good faith or not pretextual for a search for evidence, and it has to be based on either a standard procedure or a standard policy.
Now there's the problem there, right, isn't it?
I think not, Your Honor. No. I don't think there's any problem whatsoever.
Where does it explicitly say that this can be done?
The policy 9.11 of the Lakewood Police Department says open compartments are to be searched. Locked compartments shall not be opened by the officer during the standard inventory. The juxtaposition of those two terms, opened and locked, clearly defines the limits of the Lakewood police officers when they conduct an inventory. Lock, stay out of it. No reason to search it. You don't have to do it to serve any of the legitimate purposes of an inventory. You don't have to open it because you're not going to be accused of theft. It's not likely to pose any danger to the police department. And if the defendant chooses, or a defendant chooses to lock his items in there, he's done so with his own
discretion. But doesn't the problem arise in this case between the word open and unlocked?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that when you look at the officer's testimony in this case, they said open meant to search it. Open can mean open without a lid or open being unlocked. I don't think that that is an ambiguous or arbitrary decision. I think that is a common sense, practical consideration. Again, the purpose of the inventory is to do just that. Find valuables, prevent harm to police officers, prevent claims of theft by the police department or agents of the police department. To do that, to serve that purpose, you have to go into an open compartment.
Counsel, in a standard inventory of a compartment like this, it might not be unusual to find the CDs.
That's correct. In fact, in this case, there were.
And does the inventory disclose each CD?
It discloses that there were two groups of CDs taken from the vehicle, Your Honor. I believe 38 and 45 in number. And those were listed on the jail booking report for the defendant. And again, I would call the court's attention, as that question is asked, to 9.1.4 of the Lakewood inventory policy. It directs the officers, as they conduct an inventory, to make a segregation of the property. It tells them that which is valuable property, earlier defined as being in value in excess of $25, is to be returned to the defendant. And that which is contraband is to be kept. So the way Lakewood, while perhaps not the way I would choose to do it, or the court would not necessarily choose to do it, is not deficient. The officers made that segregation. The CDs were segregated out and put with the defendant's personal property at booking so that they couldn't be returned to him and were in fact returned. The weapon, on the other hand, the 9mm, the loaded 9mm handgun, clearly was contraband. And it was segregated and kept off as contraband and listed on its own report. I think the important factor, Your Honor, is that every item taken from that vehicle was listed on a piece of paper. Not one piece of paper, I will concede that, but I don't think that's what's required. I think what's required is that it's listed, that somehow there's accountability for the police department that what was in that vehicle was listed so that it could be traced. And everything that was taken from that vehicle was listed so that it could be traced.
Mr. Fry,
the
Court of Appeals, as you know, placed some significance on the fact that there currently was evidence or testimony that different police officers would apply the Lakewood ordinance differently. Isn't that the problem?
Your Honor, I think that is a mischaracterization of what the testimony was at the suppression hearing. Defense counsel continued on his examination of one of the officers, and the officer conceded that, yes, closed had a definition, and open had a definition, and closed and open didn't necessarily mean the same thing. That is not the officer, first of all, that executed the inventory search. The officer that executed the inventory search, the two officers that did, said they were to search any unlocked compartment. And again,
well, it wouldn't matter that it was that officer. What I mean, if any officer has an opinion or there's some credible testimony that says we look at this ordinance and one officer may open the unlocked compartment and another officer may not because the rule seems to...
I don't believe that was the testimony, Your Honor. I believe the testimony was, yes, I can see definitionally there could be a difference between the terms open and closed.
But it doesn't really matter what the testimony in this particular case is how it's applied across the board. Different officers are going to interpret open and
Your Honor, I think that what's important, I apologize for interrupting, I believe what's important is, did the Lakewood officers act in a uniform or consistent manner? And the answer to that question is yes. A compartment that was not locked was inventory. And again, it fits the purpose. It is the very purpose of the inventory. Counsel has attempted, before I get to that, let me just say, the other important factor here is, let's think, there was no testimony whatsoever that there was any effort made to search for evidence. In this case, this was clearly a caretaking function by the state, by the police department, and that good faith was not credited by the trial court and the court of appeals. This was not done for some ulterior purpose or motive. I would also like to distinguish the issue here between compartments and containers. Counsel for the appellate has suggested that there is no distinction to be made, but the cases that are relied on for that proposition are cases searches incident to arrest, not for inventory. Again, there is a real distinction in the inventory. The container, if it is closed and not subject to a policy that says to open the container, can be removed in total from the vehicle. It can be included as a unit in the inventory. One container, one Tupperware container, one cardboard box. It can come out in its own and get put with the property of the defendant. The compartment can't. It's unrealistic. It's not feasible to suggest that they're going to do anything if they're going to accomplish the inventory, but to open that unlocked compartment. And I think that's the essence of our argument.
So if the weapon was contained in a closed container inside the console, you couldn't go into it, right?
Unless, Your Honor, the obvious nature of it. If we get into the plain view issue, then I think that perhaps we have a different. But if it's in some innocuous container, let's say a cardboard box, it could be anything, the answer would be no, unless there was probable cause at that point to get a search warrant to open that box. I mean, there would have to be other factors.
So you could take the box, but not look in to see what the content
was. That's correct. And that's what Hathaway says. That's what Hathaway says to us. Unless there is a policy that says you open containers.
I assume that the weapon in this case was, once the lid was lifted up,
once
was in plain view.
Absolutely. The officer testified that he was startled to find the weapon and that it was in plain view as soon as he opened the lid to that center console.
I want to take you back to the procedure in the case because it's, well, you say we shouldn't be considering any of that. It becomes very important to me about how this search warrant was issued.
The arrest warrant.
Yes. When, at the motion to suppress, I think it was clearly determined that Mr. Spellacy's testimony to the magistrate was never recorded.
I would agree that that's a correct statement.
Now, what do we do with Criminal Rule 4A1, which specifically says it's not admissible unless it's recorded in some way?
Prosecutor Spellacy testified at the suppression hearing, Your Honor.
Yeah, I understand.
That he made a representation based on the purported victim, Christine Allen's statement. That's what he relayed to the trial court.
Yeah, I understand what happened. I want to know how it happened, because it says the testimony shall be admissible at the hearing on motion to suppress if it was taken down by a court reporter or recording equipment. And you concede that it was not taken down by a court reporter, no recording equipment, that he was permitted to testify that he had talked to the complainant, and this is what she said. That's what
I believe he testified that he got his information from Lakewood Police Detective John Frank, who had talked to the complainant. So the complainant did, and he had reviewed her statement.
But what do we do? Just ignore that rule?
Your Honor, first of all, again, I would draw the court's emphasis to the fact that it's not properly before the court. Judge Dowd, in a federal decision, reviewed that exact procedure of Lakewood. It is part of the record that's here on this case. We submitted it, I believe, as State's Exhibit Number 3, the decision of Judge Dowd where he held that that process did not violate, that procedure did not violate a defendant's due process rights.
I understand due process, equal protection, all that. I'm simply wanting to know about Criminal Rule 4A1. It's as clear as it can be. I mean, there's no room for interpretation of that rule. Either it has to be recorded, or it has to be taken down by a reporter.
I would agree that
neither of those happened.
That's correct, and I would agree that that didn't happen. Nonetheless, a warrant issued, an arrest warrant issued in this case.
So that makes it okay.
I'm not suggesting it makes it okay.
We found the cocaine, so the unlawful entry was okay.
I'm not saying Brown is a case that we can support. What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is the arrest warrant issue. It was acted on by the Lakeland Police Department in good faith. That issue was not preserved for review here.
I think, assuming that we take it for review, I think what Justice Douglas is suggesting is that we have to write some law on that issue. And the fact that somebody was arrested in this case in violation, or at least by not following the rule, what do we say for the next prosecutor, the next judge, or what do we say to the bench and bar about how that rule should be applied? I think that's the question.
I'm not suggesting or conceding that the arrest warrant was issued in violation of Criminal Rule 4. The arrest warrant, in fact, was issued in compliance with Criminal Rule 4. What issue is the sufficiency of the arrest warrant, and that issue. So that issue is not preserved. That challenge was not preserved. The arrest warrant can issue on the basis of the sworn complaint. And in fact, an arrest warrant was issued under Criminal Rule 4 based on a sworn complaint. The sufficiency of that complaint is what Justice Douglas is inquiring about, but that wasn't preserved. So I don't think there's new law that's necessary in this area, Your Honor. And I see that both lights are shining. I would ask that any time the court would permit would be reserved for rebuttal. My colleague, Mr.
Sack. Thank you. Some brief time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Defense attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. Mr. Messerman.
Legal arrest. It's easy to do it.
Chief Justice, this court, if I may address first a procedural issue, which tries to state absolute falsehood that the issue, the arrest issue, was not preserved. Let's just look at what the record is in this case. Mr. Justice Douglas observed that the trial hearing was held. There was an objection on the basis of Rule 4A1, specifically on the basis of Rule 4A1, to the admission of unrecorded, untranscribed testimony concerning what occurred before the magistrate who issued the arrest warrant. The argument was expressly made that the arrest was invalid and that the search that followed was invalid as either an inventory search or as a search incident to arrest. The state in the trial court stated unequivocally at page 160 of the transcript that. And the court specifically asked this question. The case we agree is page 160. Now, this case we agree does not involve search incident to arrest. Do we agree with that? And the answer was, that's correct by the prosecutor. And he stated it repeatedly. They specifically disavowed an argument which they are now raising for the first time in this court, not raised in the trial court, not raised in the Court of Appeals, not addressed by the trial court, not addressed by the Court of Appeals, that this search should be justified as incident to an arrest if it can't be justified.
Well, they had to concede that because Mesa was in the back seat of the police car handcuffed, so anything he did at that point couldn't be a threat to them.
They don't concede that because they rely upon United States versus White, the Sixth Circuit decision, instead of this court's decision in State versus Brown, and they make that argument in this court. Now,
are you finished with the waiver issue about waiving the civil rule, the failure to the criminal rule, compliance with the criminal rule? Are you finished with that?
Your Honor, there is no waiver here because we raised the issue in the Court of Appeals.
In the Court of Appeals?
We raised the issue in the Court of Appeals, and then the state did not object until the time of argument, just as is the case now.
I don't, where is it? It doesn't appear in the opinion or the assignments of error in the Court of Appeals, so I'm missing that.
Your Honor, it was in our assignment of errors.
That's not discussed in the Court of Appeals opinion?
It's not in the Court of Appeals opinion because they didn't reach our issue.
All right.
On the arrest question, they didn't reach it. They decided entirely on the inventory search question. Didn't.
You had a cross appeal? You had a cross appeal or a cross assignment of error?
No cross appeal was required, and we specifically addressed that issue in the Court of Appeals when they moved again at the time of argument to dismiss our argument, saying that it had not been preserved, and we relied upon Rule 3C2 of the Ohio Rules of Appellate Procedure, which says, quote, a person who intends to defend a judgment or order appealed by an appellant on a ground other than that relied on by the trial court, but who does not seek to change the judgment or order is not required to file a notice of cross appeal. And the same principle governs in this court because Rule 6, Section 2A of this court's Rules of Practice provides that an appellee shall file a merit brief, quote, answering the appellate's contentions and making any other appropriate contentions as reasons for affirmance of the order or judgment on which the appeal is taken.
But 2505.22, I think it is, permits you to present assignments of error on behalf of an appellee in case of reversal or in whole or in part, does it not?
Yes.
You didn't do that.
Your Honor, we presented assignments of error which include this assignment of error.
But not here, you didn't.
Yes, Your Honor. The assignment of error, proposition of law, number two, the warrant for appellee's arrest issued upon a complaint which traced the language of the statute allegedly violated and upon the unrecorded testimony of a city prosecutor who lacked probable cause and the arrest and subsequent search of appellee's vehicle pursuant to this arrest warrant violated Article 1, Section 14 of the Ohio Constitution and the 4th and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution.
Okay, you did it without setting forth 2505.22.
Sorry.
I see. No, okay.
But
I just always.
The most ironic thing about the issue for the state now to contend that the issue hasn't been preserved is that the state is arguing for the very first time in this court a proposition which does fall into question the validity of the arrest. Because the state is arguing for the very first time in this court a position that it disavowed in the trial court, specifically repudiated, that it did not present in the Court of Appeals, and that it's presenting for the first time, and we argue in our brief that that issue should be dismissed and not considered. That is, that the search is valid as incident to a lawful arrest. And that proposition is based upon well-established law as pronounced by this court. If we can then get to the appeal, I'm sorry for taking so much time. I think the only way that we can accurately and fairly review the decision of the trial court is to look at that decision, because the state makes a number of statements that simply are not true. For example, at page 2 of the state's brief, the state states that the trial court, quote, the trial court found the Lakewood Police acted in conformity with their written policy. That's absolutely false. The trial court determined that the evidence should be suppressed in this case on the basis of essentially three propositions. The first proposition is that the clearly stated Lakewood policy was violated by the police, the Lakewood police in this case. The second proposition was that there was no clearly stated policy with respect to the question of opening closed but unlocked containers. The third proposition was that there was no clearly standardized procedure with respect to the opening of closed but unlocked containers or compartments. Now, the court asked Mr. Frog whether there was an expression or a difference of opinion with respect to that matter, and there clearly was. One officer, Officer Risker, who had been with the police force for 26 years, testified at page 116 of the transcript. He was asked, what's the difference between closed and locked? answerable. If it's closed, I can open it simply by pushing a button or lifting on it. Questions, is there a difference between closed and open? Answer, yes. Question, there's a difference between closed and locked? Answer, yes. Okay, so this man understood. Closed and locked, you use a key. Closed and unlocked, you use a button. And open is open.
But did you take it a step further and say, how did you interpret the policy? I mean, you're getting into technical questions with this guy that could be used any way you want, but did you say to him as a follow-up question, how did you interpret this policy? Did you search closed but unlocked containers?
Your Honor, I wish I had. And I didn't. My next question was, do you think the people who wrote these rules are capable of using the words closed, open, and locked? And I did ask the next question. But I should add,
that's not really proof that, I mean, you can get into hyper-technical arguments about what words mean, but for common sense interpretation of a department policy, that doesn't seem like much proof.
Your Honor, I'm trying to get into hyper-technical, and I don't think this is hyper-technical. I frankly think that the state got hyper-technical. I was questioning witnesses, the record demonstrates this, but I never examined the warrant. Notwithstanding the fact that this was a warrantless search upon which the state bears the burden of proving qualifications for warrantless search under an exception. This was either an inventory search or it was an unconstitutional search.
Mr. Metzman, your argument about the officers contradicting, and really the basis for the trial court's opinion was that it seemed that the trial court inferred ambiguity from the varying testimony of the officers. But the Hathman case, as I read it, says we look at reasonable standardized procedure or established policy, established routine. And is it possible that we say that a court could say the officer's testimony goes to established routine and focus rather back to just whether or not there is established a reasonable standardized procedure?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
There is no record.
They're in the disjunctive in the Hathman case.
There is no record in this transcript sufficient to establish and satisfy the state's burden of overcoming the power of the trial court's actual determination that this was ambiguous and that there is no evidence
but
in this case of established routine.
Okay.
There is no evidence.
It seemed to me perhaps that the trial court's assessment of ambiguity arose under one of the two prongs under Hathman rather than both, or perhaps a merging of those two prongs, which really are distinct and disjunctive.
I think the trial court's assessment of ambiguity was based upon a number of things that were clearly stated, and I would like to very quickly review them. The testimony of another officer listener, who was the one who conducted the search, you know what a closed compartment is? Yes. What is it? By the way, this officer was extremely reluctant to talk about what an inventory was. But he said it's a compartment that's closed but not locked. That was his answer. And you know what an open compartment is? An answer. He was saying open compartment would be something that would be open to plain view. So you have yet a different question. What the trial court did, considering all of this testimony and pursuant to the fundamental principle that the findings the trial court confirmed, unless there's evidence to the contrary. He said, these are his findings at page 7 of the opinion.
I think each of us probably has reviewed that, but my question more goes to, is this under the Hathman test, do we apply an objective review of the criteria of standard, reasonable standard procedures? Do we apply an objective test? Or do we apply a subjective test? I would think we do apply subjective to the second prong.
Your Honor, whether you apply objective or subjective, you reach the same result.
Okay.
If you apply an objective test, if we compare this regulation to Peyton's Fiedler case, for example. Fiedler case, they talked about open, they talked about closed, they
right.
talked about both compartments, they talked about trunks, they talked about unlocked, they talked about locked.
Right.
Objectively appraised, there's nothing here about locked and unlocked, it's just open or closed. So there's nothing about locked or unlocked.
Locked is in the procedures. The term locked is in.
Yes, I'm sorry, there's nothing about closed.
All right.
policy. This court said it happened. If you have regulations, you have to show compliance with them. There was no compliance.
Does that go to the good faith requirement?
Your Honor, good faith is not something that will satisfy the constitutional requirements for a warrantless search, even a warrantless inventory.
Oh, I know, not on its own, but you, I thought maybe the failure to comply, are you arguing that that shows a lack of good faith, which is a part of it?
It's not the argument that we're making, Your Honor, although it's an argument that could be made, because this can't be eradicated by good faith. The simple fact of the matter is there was no inventory, and the state has argued to the contrary, and there is no factual basis for that argument, because the purpose of the inventory search, and there are a number of cases that say without an inventory, there is no inventory search, and that is specifically what the trial judge found in this case. He said these factors taken together tended to demonstrate that the seizure of the weapon was other than incident to an inventory search. No inventory, no inventory search. The same result was reached in the Himmelhaber case, which we from Claremont County, which was cited to the court. No inventory search. There is nothing remotely resembling an inventory, notwithstanding the state's arguments to the contrary. What they have is a property sheet that was not prepared by the searching officer, and not signed by the searching officer, and not been a testament or certification by the searching officer concerning what he found. Then we have a supplemental report in which he says that he found a gun. Well, the court found that this was not an inventory. And the court determined, page 11, Lakewood's written policy was patently violated in at least two important respects. There were two opportunities pursuant to the regulations to prepare a list of what was taken, and that's the whole purpose of the inventory search. First, said the trial court, the separate report was not generated, listing any and all property removed from the vehicle. And second, none of the property taken into custody was listed in the tow release form. These are patent violations of the express, clearly stated, unambiguous provisions in the Lakewood regulations.
Counsel, an inventory, does that vary from police department to police department?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the practices from police department to police department, but an inventory,
typically an inventory lists everything seized.
Right.
Doesn't it ask the defendant to, or whoever was controlling the property, sign and acknowledge that those items were seized?
Your Honor, that is a different matter. Typically, an inventory, by definition, I suppose, if it's to achieve the objectives of an inventory search, is something prepared contemporaneously, or essentially contemporaneously, with the officer who conducts the search. In this case, there is no such document. There is a document which the court specifically found was not in an inventory. That is a receipt signed only by the defendant in this case, saying, this is what I received, this is what was taken from me. It included his immigration card, his papers, his currency, etc. It did not include the gun. And it was not, did not purport to be an inventory of the items taken.
Well, in your opinion, you're contending this is not an inventory search. What would have to have taken place in order to make it an inventory search?
Your Honor, that is not just my opinion. It's the 12th.
I understand. I just want to hear from you what is necessary.
The evidence in this case demonstrates that six police officers went out and spent several hours arresting a man with a prior record on a fourth degree felony charge. They followed him from his home into the Flats entertainment area of the city of Cleveland. There were a number, all six of these people, at least. And then,
well, I'm just talking about, I understand that. When we get to the vehicle, what were they doing with that vehicle?
When we get to the vehicle, Your Honor, inventory, preparation of inventory would require a searching officer to dispose it from the vehicle. The searching officer never did that. That's all it would require. It's not a very startling kind of requirement. There was sufficient manpower. There were no exigent circumstances.
And since that wasn't done, it's not an inventory search.
That's right.
The state grand jury was done on a different list. The list that was items to be returned versus the list that was contraband.
Your Honor, I've attempted to address that question in order to address that question, one has to look simply at the exhibits that were actually offered. What the state is referring to as a separate list. It's a very ingenious argument. It didn't work with the court. The trial court didn't work with the Court of Appeals, and it shouldn't work with this court. There is a document, State's Exhibit 4. State's Exhibit 4 was specifically referred to in the testimony, and I won't find the transcript reference at this point, said this was not an inventory. This was not prepared by anyone who participated in the search. This was not prepared by the person who took the items from the automobile. This is not a type document. This is a handwritten document that was prepared by the jailer and submitted to Mr. Mesa at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning for his signature as one of the conditions of his release. That's what it was.
So that's the list of what he took on.
This is the list of... It is a list that was signed. It is not certified as an inventory list. It is not, the accuracy of it is not the
same as the CDs.
That's right. That's right.
Well, if it wasn't a search incident to arrest, and it wasn't an inventory search, there was no search. But there was.
Well, but there was a search, and if it wasn't incident to an arrest, then since there was no warrant, it was an invalid search. And it violates the Fourth Amendment, and it must be suppressed, and that's what the trial court determined. Now the court said that the prosecutor argues it's a search incident to an arrest. We argue that they didn't raise that issue, should be permitted to raise it here, but even if they could raise it, under this court's decision, State versus Brown, it's very clear this is not a valid search incident to an arrest. Secondly, the arrest was illegal for the reasons that we've stated, and we think the issue is one very important, and that is whether or not a trial court can blindly and over objection ignore the requirements of Rule 4A1, which obviously was enacted for a purpose and which has been implemented by the Sixth Circuit in the Tabasco case and by the Court of Appeals in the Shingles case, and we think that it is sufficient basis.
So I gather there is a second, and that is the document in which the gun is reflected.
There is a document.
And what's the nature of that document?
That document, Your Honor, is exhibits, it's actually two documents. It's exhibits 3 and 5, and there was testimony, State exhibits 3 and 5, that State exhibit 5, which is a typewritten report, is a report of the seizure of the gun.
And how is that denominated? What's it claimed to be?
Claimed to be a supplementary report. That's what it's called, supplementary report.
And
it's attached to it is a property description. And we're proposing that we're on the rear side of the side of it. It's a handwritten document which says Lakewood Police Department is a property description. And it lists two items, non-bullets, and digits in the post on 96 inside. This is signed by Lister. And Judge Cronin determined that that did not satisfy the inventory requirement for a number of reasons. First of all, there were two explicit inventory requirements, two contemporaneously at the time, and compared to this, one and two, he told me he's going to use the total piece, which the judge sets forth in his opinion, page 12, which is supposed to list what was taken, and there was nothing listed on the total piece. So in order to satisfy the requirements, search rendered unconstitutional under the inventory exception. What the court said is you can't have an inventory. You can't satisfy it based on that.
What you have acknowledged is that an inventory could be more than one document.
An inventory
properly done.
An inventory could be more than one document.
And some items like CDs and things that are going back would be on one page and on a separate page, if properly done.
Yeah, the problem here is not that it was on more than one page. The problem here is that no one who was responsible for conducting the inventory, who seized and cataloged what was taken, who operated under the exception which permits warrantless searches for the purpose of protecting the owner's property, protecting themselves against false claims, and protecting against allegations of false theft, etc. There was no
compliance with that requirement. That is a rigid requirement. This court says the United States Supreme Court can conduct warrantless searches. So that this issue, this case, doesn't turn upon whether a counsel is a retainer or a compartment. It doesn't really turn upon the issue of whether it's necessary to identify containers and compartments and determine precisely which is which. It turns upon much more fundamental practices, and that is compliance with the inventory requirement for the purpose of assuring that what is done is designed to provide a reasonably accurate account of what occurred in the course of a warrantless search.
Thank you, Mr. Messerman. Mr. Satt, you're going to take rebuttal. Mr. Messerman has taken, we've given him considerably more time, so let's start with a minute.
Thank you, Justice. Nice to meet you, sir. Well, let me start off by saying that something so simple as to what the language is entered today is being made so complicated and by description. What is an inventory search? It does not implicate Fourth Amendment concerns. Inventory search is nothing more than a bookkeeping function. The Lakewood police officers go down there, they have an arrest warrant. And that arrest warrant, Justice Douglas, is not the subject matter of this case. There was no prosecution, no matter how Mr. Messerman tries to characterize the arrest. It's not the subject matter of this court.
Doesn't excuse the violation, does it, Mr. Satt?
He waived it. And you can waive Fourth Amendment rights, that's Jackson versus First, and what was done here. You failed to cross appeal. It's as simple as that.
Well, haven't you waived the search incident to arrest?
No, because we're responding to page 13 on Mr. Messerman's argument.
And he's responding in propositional law 2 to your argument.
No, that's raised for the first time before this court. Mr. Messerman on page 13 of his brief says this was not an inventory search. So if it's not an inventory search, what is it? That's the same question you asked, Justice Douglas. Of course what it is. It's a search incident to arrest. You can go on two grounds. You have an alternative ground to rely on. And it was raised for the first time by Justice Blackmun in the Court of Appeals. Not like Mr. Messerman characterizes it, unraised by anyone in the Court of Appeals. The very first question that she asked Mr. Fry is the state relying on New York versus Belton. And you know what that case stands for. That's very simple. But let's look at how the simplicity of this case develops. We have great decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court. We have great decisions from the Ohio Supreme Court. The decisions of the United States Supreme Court are South Dakota versus Huffman. This gives the officers full right to go into a compartment. This is what South Dakota stands for. We have Colorado versus Bertine. We have Florida versus Wells. And we see that the history and the development of the law of search and seizure allows police officers to go in and search not just inventory searches. The range of search incident to arrest is extremely broad for the prosecution. But let's look at Opperman. Opperman says, unlock the glove compartment, okay. Well, obviously, people don't pry with the glove compartment, saying, oh, I don't know too many people. People don't pry with their vehicles with the center console open. They are not,
counsel, let's deal with the last issue that Mr. Messerman was seeking to amend, whether his argument that you can't have a search incident to an inventory if you don't have an inventory.
There was an inventory, no matter how many pieces of paper, whether or not they were in all 1 sheet, 10 sheets, 15 sheets, Justice Breyer, it's an inventory. It's a ministerial duty. This ministerial duty was carried out. Everything that was taken from that vehicle was listed. Police officers
required it. This is inventory typically done by the paperwork filled out by the person who actually did the inventory.
Correct. And others too. We rely on the police officers, rely on the collective knowledge of each other. And what was taken and listed. There's no allegation here that something was taken that was not listed.
It was assigned by the officer who actually did the physical inventory.
It does not necessarily have to be assigned by that exact officer. Officers at the scene can say what was taken, what we took it down from this car. We listed it on an inventory sheet. That's fine. What is the standard policy? It's the standard policy of the police department. What was their policy? That open compartments are to be searched. Locked compartments cannot be opened, because that is the purpose. If it's locked, then the officer fears nothing. There's no claims of loss.
So it's unimportant. It is unimportant. It doesn't matter who signs the paper.
No, I don't think it matters as long as there's a listing of what was taken from
the car. Generally, it would, because you need the chain of evidence and you don't want to interject hearsay into that.
Well, we would put, in a case like that, the chain of evidence would be preserved. The state would call the officers necessary that watch the gun, seize the gun, et cetera. Who listed it? That's ministerial.
Well, but you also argue you win even if it's not an inventory search.
I'm arguing that this wasn't valid inventory search. There's no question about it. All they did is simply, what luck did the officers do? They opened up the center console, which was open. It was an open compartment. It was not locked. They found a gun. They listed everything they took from cassettes and everything else. That's as simple as that. It was done in good faith. It was not pursuant to standardized police procedures or an articulated policy which they expressed. It's not a complicated case.
I guess I want to ask the same question Justice Piper does. It seems to me that I was interested in Mr. Messerman's argument that the purpose for having requiring the officer requiring an officer make an inventory at the site of the items that are found in the car, that they're the inventory, that protects not only the defendant, but it also protects the officer, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't seem to me it's more than ministerial. It seems to me it's a very important element of the inventory search, whether or not it's an inventory search, because if you wait till the stuff is brought into the police station and somebody rummages through it and puts it down on a piece of paper, obviously something can happen in between, can't it?
It could have been listed more accurately in terms of the top page saying inventory. It wasn't done that way. But everything that was taken from the car was listed. And there's no accusation that everything that was taken from Mace's car was not listed.
Well, his argument
is that therefore it did become ministerial in nature.
His argument is that the person who actually makes the inventory, takes the inventory at the scene, that signature is missing on this so-called inventory.
But it's not fatal or defective to bookkeeping functions. The inventory is not, in all the cases from Opperman to Wells to routine, say it doesn't implicate Fourth Amendment concerns. It's a bookkeeping function, whether or not labor and police could have done their job better by listing inventory, having the officer sign it, does not negate the fact that the inventory was complete, whether it be on one sheet, two sheets, and whether or not the exact officer who saw this, they all would testify as to what happened, and that's what's going to be presented at the case. So Mr. Messerman's concern trying to raise that lack of a signature does not raise any constitutional concerns, given the fact that Opperman and Colorado versus Bertine and Florida versus Wells say that no Fourth Amendment implication is triggered by an inventory search here. And finally, I'd like to state that, again, coming back and giving this court an alternative, if you found that the inventory is defective, then I would simply say that you have under New York versus Belton the right to find and listen to arrest, and it was a search contemporary to the arrest.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.